From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Asian American community is reeling from a year of hate and racist attacks that culminated in last week's horrific shooting at three Atlanta area spas in Georgia, claiming the lives of six Asian women and two others. While Donald Trump's anti-China rhetoric clearly opened the floodgates of anti-Asian hate since the start of the pandemic, President Joe Biden's continuation of a hostile posture toward China may also not be helping. And beyond current events, there's a deep history of anti-Asian racism in this nation, symbolized by immigration policies and white racist mobs, as well as in the realm of U.S. foreign policy and war that has dehumanized Asian bodies, particularly those of women. My guests are Mei-Lin Hong, Assistant Professor of Literature at the University of California, Merced, and co-chair of the Circle for Asian American Literary Studies. She's also a former attorney writing about race, gender, refugees, and justice. And Terry Park is a lecturer in the Asian American Studies program at the University of Maryland in College Park. He recently co-authored an article in The Nation magazine called Anti-Asian Violence in America is Rooted in U.S. Empire. Welcome to the program, Mei-Lin and Terry.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Mei-Lin, I'd like to start with you. I know it seems obvious to say this right now, but I think it's worth repeating. The anti-China, the racist rhetoric emanating from President Donald Trump since the start of the pandemic last year, all the way through till January or till the point where he was kicked off of Twitter. Do you see a direct line between that rhetoric echoed in his base and the attacks that happened last week in Atlanta?
Absolutely, absolutely. The reason that it had an effect is because the rhetoric from President Trump and a lot of his supporters and enablers called upon a very long history of anti-Asian sentiment and anti-Asian narratives in the United States. So the kinds of rhetoric that he was using when he was using shortcuts like calling the coronavirus the China virus or saying Kung Flu, he was calling upon entire narratives that people already had available to them that depicted Asian and Asian American people as being foreign, disease carrying, threatening, and just simply unassimilable and not belonging in the United States. Because those narratives were already available when President Trump used rhetoric like he did, he was able to activate a whole history of anti-Asian sentiment.
Terry, would you like to add to that? Do you also see this direct link between Trump's rhetoric, the huge numbers of anti-Asian racist rhetoric, and even things that would qualify as hate crimes? The Stop AAPI Hate organization has documented thousands of incidents from the past year alone and saw a clear spike after Trump started tweeting.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, there is a lot of evidence to show that his hateful rhetoric of using words like Kung Flu and China virus have directly translated into almost 4,000 attacks on Asian and Asian Americans, and especially targeting the most vulnerable in our population, from the elderly to low-wage workers, and what we witnessed this past week in Atlanta with the violent targeting of six Asian women. So yes, definitely. But at the same time, as my colleague suggested, it's important to place this in a much longer historical context of anti-Asian violence that has been built in to many of our institutions, and also thinking transnationally, which is something that my colleagues that I wrote the Nation article with, who organize with Women Cross DMZ, are trying to point out that US foreign policy, US militarism, the three disastrous wars with various Asian countries in the 20th century have led to attacks on Asian and Asian American communities. So I think it's important to make that international link to understand why there is this increase in violence not just under the Trump administration, but also under the Biden administration.
And I want to get to Biden in just a moment. But there was a hearing recently, you know, after the Atlanta shootings, that the House Judiciary Committee held a hearing that several Asian American members of Congress, were leading in. And it was remarkable to see Republican responses to the entreaties from their Democratic colleagues to please stop fueling hate. Their responses were rooted in their right to continue criticizing China. And I'm wondering if, Maylin, if you think that that is precisely the problem. Their response and their tone deafness is precisely part of the problem.
Sure. Yeah. And I think tone deafness is a generous way to put
yes, it.
Because it is. I think that, you know, I think these political leaders who are continuing to fuel anti-China sentiment know perfectly well that throughout American history, Americans have been terrible about distinguishing between Asians in Asia and Asians in the United States. So what my colleague was saying about the international link here is very, very important, because the way that Americans, especially white Americans, understand Asians in America is that we are attached to a country somewhere else, even if our families have been here for eight generations. So that rhetoric that we saw really explode out just, appallingly during that hearing that should have centered the pain and suffering of Asian Americans in the United States was disingenuous, to say the least, and it was violent. It committed a kind of violence on its own, because it was calling for a continuation of what we have seen over the past year. And I want to say that when this happens, it's certain communities that suffer the most. So the Asian American community is very, very diverse. And in what happened in the past week, we see that Asian and Asian American women, especially those who are recent immigrants, especially those who perform care labor, especially those who are in professions where they are not protected by the police, these are communities that are going to be especially vulnerable. As soon as the hateful rhetoric started in March of last year, AAPI Hate started tracking the hate crimes, because we knew, all of us knew who were observing and knew anything of this history, knew that this was going to be the culmination, this kind of violence.
Let's go to what has happened under the Biden administration. Obviously, it makes a huge difference to not have a president who's constantly blaming China for somehow engineering, creating, spreading a virus, calling it the Chinese virus, when, of course, viruses don't have an ethnicity or national origin. Obviously, that makes a big difference. However, even during his campaign, President Biden made it clear that he wanted to sort of continue a U.S. tradition of hostile posturing toward China. And just as the Atlanta shootings were happening, that was continuing. There were talks between Chinese and U.S. representatives, and the U.S. media was eagerly covering the U.S.'s hostile posture toward China. And of course, it's important for any country to be able to have a foreign policy that it deems necessary, and not necessarily shy away from, say, criticizing human rights violations. But Terry, I'm wondering whether you think the Biden administration could be more sensitive.
I definitely think they can, and especially if President Biden promised that Asian Americans would be protected, would feel like Americans as they are, then these mixed messages that we're getting from Secretary Blinken and others who are ramping up their hawkish rhetoric towards China, continuing military exercises off the coast of not just China, but also North Korea, saying that they are ready to fight today against North Korea if they have to, is not just disconcerting, but makes the bullseye that is on our backs as Asian Americans that much larger. Because, as my colleague mentioned, this notion that Asian Americans, no matter if they were born here, no matter if we have lived here most of our lives, are perpetual foreigners. And that lingering air of suspicion can become weaponized and even deadly, as we saw last week, and in fact, the last year, where, again, almost 70% of around the almost 4,000 attacks reported against Asian Americans have been women. So I would hope that the Biden administration can engage in more peaceful dialogue with China, with North Korea. And in fact, my colleagues at Women Cross DMZ are very adamant in pushing the Biden administration to finally end the Korean War, to sign a peace treaty, and therefore not just lessen tensions and hostilities in the Asian Pacific region, but to also make us Asian Americans to make our lives that much more secure in our own country.
And I'm wondering, Malin, if you can give our audience a sense of how you have viewed not just anti-Asian bias here in the United States, but specific stereotypes around Asian women. Women as being these sexualized objects, sexually available and or submissive, particularly in the context of the Atlanta spas, where this young white man allegedly who's being charged with the 8 murders, who claimed he had a sex addiction in a way that was just sort of brushed aside as a good enough justification by the police. How all of that fits with the narrative, a deeply disturbing narrative that dehumanizes and sexualizes Asian women in the United States?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, like you say, Sonali, Asian and Asian American women have long been dehumanized, overly sexualized, fetishized, and depicted through certain stereotypes in popular media, in the movies, in literature, in public discourse. They are the punchlines of jokes on late night TV and in TV shows. It's common to use terms like yellow fever. It's common to use terms like dragon lady. All of these stereotypes have an effect, because they make certain narratives more available to our imaginations when we think about Asian and Asian American women. And so regardless of what an Asian or Asian American woman does for a living, regardless of what her personal traits are, when she walks down the street and phenotypically displays certain traits, she's going to be associated with those stereotypes. And I know my colleague has written beautifully about the impact of the wars in Asia and continuing US military empire, which have forced women throughout Asia into prostitution and into other forms of sex work, basically reinforcing these stereotypes over and over again. This is a violence that continues, and it's part of our culture. Now, if the suspect says that he has sex addiction, let's just say, allow him to say that for now. If he says that he has sex addiction has to manifest in a particular way, right? It has to manifest in a way that makes cultural sense. And it can't make cultural sense for him to, as he said, or as law enforcement said, to eliminate the temptation by killing women. That makes no sense unless you view Asian and Asian American women as intrinsically sexual objects and as objects for white male entitlement, violence, and conquest. So if those narratives weren't available to him already, this sex addiction narrative would make no sense at all. And it doesn't make sense to those of us who are observing and critiquing. Mm.
And Terry, picking up on what Malin was just saying, the U.S. has fought so many wars in East Asia. I mean, Korea, which we were mentioning earlier, of course, and ongoing hostilities with North Korea, the Vietnam War, of course, being such an important aspect of it, Laos and Cambodia, and today the hostilities with China, and of course, Japan in World War II. That history and interactions between U.S. soldiers in those countries and how it has manifested here also through immigration, all of that complex history does play into the long arc of anti-Asian racism on U.S. soil, right?
Absolutely. And as my colleague mentioned, wherever the U.S. military has fought wars or have built these military bases, in fact, there are over 300 of them circling China, circling North Korea, we have seen the construction of what are called camp towns, which are these spaces immediately surrounding these US military bases that attract many poor rural women to engage in exploited, violent forms of sexualized labor. And again, that's where we get a lot of these stereotypes of Asian and Asian American women as quote unquote lotus blossoms or quote unquote dragon ladies. And we have seen these images infiltrate numerous Hollywood films, from The World of Susie Wong to Full Metal Jacket to Rush Hour 2. I mean, we can probably list numerous TV shows, films, Broadway musicals like Miss Saigon that give fuel to these sexualized fantasies that are at the same time incredibly racist. So that's why my colleagues at Women Cross DMZ are adamant about ending the Korean War and ramping down hawkish rhetoric and U.S. militarism, because it can actually help Asian and Asian American women be seen less as objects or temptations to be eliminated by white supremacist shooters.
And I'm also wondering what we do now in this moment to address what has happened. I mean, certainly Biden could tamp down the rhetoric, you know, ratchet down the anti-China rhetoric, work toward peace. But in the domestic realm, Malin, I'm wondering what your opinion is of the resolution that some Asian American members of Congress have introduced. I know Grace Meng has introduced them. Judy Chu, she's my congressional representative. She was the first Asian, first Chinese woman to ever be elected to Congress, Chinese American woman. She has spoken out about these issues, and a lot of our Asian American members of Congress have led the charge to address anti-Asian violence. Is it enough? What are some of the things that you would like to see happen to take on this issue? There were thousands of people that showed up at rallies across the nation this past weekend, which shows that there's a deep sense of solidarity in the United States to address especially what happened in Atlanta.
Yeah, thank you for that question. So the resolution that was reintroduced with a few alterations.
It was initially introduced before the Atlanta shootings.
That's right. And it was revised and reintroduced by Representative Meng. And it's important, but it's symbolic, right? So it's not important for the reasons that most people might think. So a resolution like that doesn't actually change any laws. It doesn't allocate funds for any particular initiatives. It doesn't force anyone to do anything. But it is still important, because what we're seeing is a new generation of Asian American leadership in Washington taking on an issue that is dear to their hearts and that matters to their community. And we're seeing their colleagues, other politicians, support them in it. So what we're seeing is changes in the narratives that are available to us. So if before we had these images of Asian and Asian American women as sexualized and subservient, et cetera, as largely voiceless politically, now we're also seeing strong women take a stand. And I think that's important. Alongside that, we also need a lot more education of the public about how racism and misogyny work. So we've seen a lot of responses that are along the lines of, well, I could see how maybe this is racist, but I don't see it as being about gender, or I see it as being about gender, but not about race. So there definitely needs to be more of an intersectional framework, and there needs to be an understanding at the highest levels of how these issues play out. So there needs to be a way to think about critiques of China at an inopportune moment for the Asian American community as contributing to ongoing violence, that racism enacts itself in our culture and is perpetuated by the things that we do and say. So I love to see these representatives reintroducing this resolution. I'd also love for them to turn some of the sentiments that are in the resolution into actual enactments in the law and budget allocations, and for them to give voice to a lot of the organizations that have been working on the ground for many generations to support Asian American communities across the country. These are all really important steps, and we need much better education about ethnic groups in the United States about how race and racism function in the United States so that we don't have these completely absurd press conferences where a mass shooter who targeted Asian women can say, it was my sex addiction. This is a completely absurd story, but it makes sense to a public that is uneducated about how race and misogyny work.
And for the police, in particular, the Cherokee County captain, I believe his name was Jay Baker, to defend what the alleged shooter did and sort of brush it aside in such a sympathetic way really suggests that this is about white supremacy, right? About patriarchy, of we're police and police departments and police brutality and police racism are centered. Do you see this? And this question is to both you, Terry, and Maylin. Do you see how these shootings manifested and the defense of the shootings, if you will, as part of that spectrum of white supremacy and police brutality?
Yes, it's extremely important to say that more policing and more criminal punishment are not the answer here. We're talking about a community of women who have never really been protected by the police. So if they are perceived as sex workers or as adjacent to sex work in any way, that is an entire profession that has been criminalized and brutalized by law enforcement for many decades, right? So to have a police force, a whole law enforcement infrastructure that doesn't understand racism and misogyny step in to be the answer after the spectacles that we have seen in response to these shootings, those are simply not the answer.
And then let's also talk about the fact that we are in this moment where Asian Americans have also, and really it's not just a moment, it's for the past couple of decades, Asian Americans have been really used to fuel a racial resentment amongst white communities around issues regarding affirmative action in academia. They're seen as a model minority that enjoys better socioeconomic status than even in some studies white Americans. All of this does serve to fuel racial resentment, right, Terry?
It does. And I'm thinking specifically about the work of my mentor at the University of Maryland, Janelle Wong, who has written extensively on affirmative action and other race-based policies and how Asian Americans have often been used as a wedge to divide Asian Americans from Black Americans and other communities of color, and to let white supremacist institutions and practices go scot-free. So I think that's why it's more important to build off of what my colleague Dr. Hong said, to really think about what kinds of institutions do we want to protect us. When we have seen the police not only commit decades of brutality against Black and brown communities, but also against Asian Americans. And I'm thinking last week, the day before the horrific Atlanta massacre, the deportation of 33 Vietnamese who illustrate decades-long targeting of Southeast Asians who are the products of US militarism and war in Asia, who face incredible amounts of poverty, lack of access to important resources, who do not fit that model minority stereotype. So again, I think it's important, building off of this need of educating the public about Asian Americans, to not reinforce this monolithic view that all Asian Americans are crazy rich Asians, that in fact, the group that experiences the highest amount of poverty in New York City are Chinese Americans, that the greatest wealth gap among all of the different racial groups are Asian Americans. And so those more invisibilized forms of violence, of deportation, detention, poverty, and how all of that is heavily gendered and sexualized as well, I think needs to be discussed in order to have a more expansive understanding of anti-Asian violence.
Well, I want to thank the two of you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate this deep discussion into the roots of anti-Asian racism in the U.S. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
My pleasure.
My guests have been Meilin Hong, Assistant Professor of Literature at the University of California, Merced, and Terry Park, who is a lecturer at the Asian American Studies Program at the University of Maryland in College Park. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter to find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.